From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a critique of the press by one of its own. We talk with Washington Post media critic Howard Kurtz. His new book, Media Circus, is about the stories the press has fumbled or botched and the difficult ethical decisions reporters face. Actor Evan Handler had leukemia. He found the medical ordeal that saved his life both truly horrible and terribly funny. That ordeal is the basis of his new monodrama, Time on Fire, a comedy of terrors. Coming up, he'll perform an excerpt and talk with us about it. And writer Elizabeth Kay is skeptical about the new birth control device known as the female condom. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton was in Milwaukee today trying to drum up support for his deficit reduction plan in a direct appeal to the people. The Senate is scheduled to begin debate next week on the package, which only narrowly passed the House. The president said he's willing to accept deeper budget cuts and fewer taxes if Congress will leave his domestic spending plan intact. Political leaders in Guatemala say the country's president, Jorge Serrano, has resigned. They say he'll be replaced by an interim coalition government. Tom Gibb reports from Guatemala City.
President Serrano's resignation comes exactly a week after he suspended the Constitution and dissolved the Congress and Supreme Court. A large crowd is already celebrating outside the National Palace. President Serrano and members of the country's constitutional court, which he also dissolved last week, are meeting inside. Political leaders say an interim government of national unity will be formed. They say it's likely to be led by Arturo Herbruger, until now the president of the Supreme Electoral Tribunal. Serrano was forced to resign after his action was condemned by almost every group inside the country. The international community, led by the United States, were also threatening economic sanctions unless constitutional order was restored. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in Guatemala City.
The Cambodian government is demanding a repeat vote in four provinces because of alleged election fraud. The government appears to be losing the election. The six-day voting period was organized and pronounced free and fair by the United Nations. Jonathan Burchell reports for the BBC that the dispute could ruin the UN-brokered peace in Cambodia.
The key point at the moment is that it's not yet clear whether the Cambodian People's Party is intent on holding on to power at any cost, or whether this is a maneuver aimed at essentially strengthening their position in the negotiations which will follow over the creation of some sort of coalition in the new constitutional assembly. The theory being that the more difficult they make every step of the way, the stronger their position will be in the negotiations, which will be with Fun Sin Pek, the main royalist opposition party, which it seems inevitable that Fun Sin Pek is now going to emerge with the largest number of seats in that new constitutional assembly.
Jonathan Burchell in Phnom Penh. The UN reports that with 60% of the ballots counted, the main opposition party is ahead with 42% of the vote. The ruling party has 37%. Final results are expected this week. The elections are the culmination of a UN-sponsored peace process to end Cambodia's 13-year civil war. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 25 points to close at 3,552. Advances led declines by 2-1. This is NPR. Libyan pilgrims in Jerusalem have cut short their visit after angering Israelis and Palestinians alike and spreading controversy as far as Saudi Arabia. The Libyans were the first to visit Muslim holy sites in Israel, but their visit angered Palestinians who say it's too soon to normalize relations with the Jewish state. Israelis were angered when the leader of the Libyan group called on Muslims to liberate Jerusalem. Saudi Arabia was angered when Libya said it sent the pilgrims to Israel because they were refused permission to make the pilgrimage to the Saudi city of Mecca. The Saudi government said it welcomes pilgrims from Libya. France's conservative interior minister says his government's objective is to stop immigration. Tomorrow, the French government will discuss another proposal to clamp down on foreigners moving into the country. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
In an interview in the respected Daily Le Monde, Interior Minister Charles Pasqua, said the objective we've assigned ourselves is to move towards zero immigration. He said this will be impossible to achieve since the French economy occasionally needs specialized workers. But he said this is the direction we're moving towards. We need to reduce the number of new immigrants as much as possible. About 100,000 legal immigrants come to France every year, including political refugees. Pasqua said France would continue to accept political refugees, but he indicated that the country can no longer absorb the others. Tomorrow, the government will discuss a bill designed to reduce the number of foreigners in France. It also gives border police the authority to refuse political refugees. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Today is the official beginning of the Atlantic Caribbean hurricane season, but the first potential storm of the year drifted harmlessly out to sea. The tropical depression dumped heavy rains on Cuba and South Florida, but the winds never picked up enough to qualify it as a tropical storm. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A standing joke in the Washington Post newsroom is that people get nervous when they see Howard Kurtz coming with pen and pad. Kurtz is the Post's media critic and is sometimes in the awkward position of reporting on the work of his colleagues at the Post. He says he tries to hold journalists accountable to the same standards they hold politicians to. Kurtz has written a new book called Media Circus, which he describes as his attempt to examine what has gone wrong with the profession he loves. Kurtz learned how hard it can be to report on your own paper when he wrote about Post reporter Juan Williams. Williams had written an op-ed piece in the paper supporting Clarence Thomas, saying there was no credible evidence for Anita Hill's allegations. Kurtz learned that Williams himself had been accused of sexual harassment.
That was probably the most difficult episode I've ever had to handle in my job as the media critic. But there really was very little choice because it was such a supercharged atmosphere because of Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. And Juan Williams had gotten so much attention for defending Clarence Thomas against the sexual harassment charges. I got into it very simply because a couple of women in the newsroom called me and said, you ought to know that there's an inquiry going on involving Juan Williams. I quickly determined that this had to be news, that this would be news if it was happening in any other newspaper, wanted to write about it, was initially stopped by my bosses from writing about it for the very simple reason that they felt there was a confidential personnel process going on. Juan Williams was entitled to his day in court, so to speak. I argued, unsuccessfully at first, that this was going to come out, that other people were going to write about it and broadcast it, and the Post may as well get into it and let everybody have their say. Once a local television station did report the news that there was this inquiry going on, I did finally got, this is 2 or 3 days later, I got the green light to go ahead and write it, and I reflected the point of view of the editors, Juan Williams' feelings, and everybody else who had a hand in this story. It was a very tense time in the newsroom, and there was really no way to avoid the subject.
But you had to wait till somebody else broke the story, and then you were able to write about it?
That is the only time that has happened, and I don't know what would have happened had a local television station not written it first. I mean, I have a feeling that sooner or later the editors of the Post would have decided, uncomfortable as it made everybody feel, that this was news, that we had become part of the story, that one of our most prominent writers, like it or not, was now part of the Clarence Thomas story. But in this particular instance, the fact that somebody else went first, and things often work like this in the news business, when somebody pops a story, when somebody puts it in play, that gives you the opportunity to jump into it without a heck of a lot more thought.
Let's talk a little bit about the White House and the Clinton administration. President Clinton just replaced George Stephanopoulos with David Gergen. What does that say to you?
It says to me that Clinton realizes that he has a problem with the press. I mean, obviously, there are many levels here. There's also Clinton trying to move a little bit toward the center and correct what some see as the leftward drift of his administration. But from a press perspective, you know, there was a lot of talk after what I call the talk show campaign, the campaign of last year that relied so heavily on Larry King and Arsenio and MTV, that the traditional press didn't matter anymore, that a president could just simply go around the Beltway press corps, go on talk shows, do satellite interviews with local anchors, and basically the heck with the people like me who like to ask adversarial questions. I think there's a recognition here that Clinton's been hurt by that, that like it or not, and sometimes I think the Beltway press corps is too self-absorbed and too prosecutorial, but they're there and they're going to be a major filter between any president, any politician, and the American people. And so I think the president recognizes that he perhaps needs to do a little better job of getting his message out to the people who, not just print reporters, but network types who cover him every day and maybe have a few less stories about $200 haircuts.
What was George Stephanopoulos' reputation among the reporters that covered the White House?
Most reporters like George Stephanopoulos. They think he's a very straight shooter. They thought he was a very sure hand during the campaign. There was a little bit of a feeling that perhaps he was overloaded, that from a strategic point of view, perhaps he was not doing as well or the administration was not doing as well as it might. But basically, reporters trusted Stephanopoulos, although he could be very frustrating at briefings because he's developed about 4,000 ways of not saying anything when we demand to know what it is the president's going to do tomorrow or next week.
I just judging him from the sitting at home watching C-SPAN angle, yeah. He was kind of boring at the briefings. I mean, when he would tell you nothing, he wouldn't tell you nothing with flair.
Right, it's the spokesman's job to tell you nothing, but to make you like it.
And to have a sense of irony
could be a
about
on
it.
Dull
or something.
Side.
Yeah, right.
Dee Dee Myers, I think, does it with a little more humor, and we'll probably see more of her at these daily briefings.
No, is that important? Does that matter?
It matters in a sort of an indirect sense. I mean, initially the Clinton White House tried to televise these briefings, and what they got was, 30 minutes a day of reporters and Stephanopoulos shouting at each other, and they quickly pulled the plug on that. It matters in the sense that if the White House press corps feels like it's getting stiffed, if it feels like it's not getting information, if it feels like the spokesmen are basically blowing them off, I think that attitude then creeps its way into the copy. Many reporters would deny this, but I think that to the extent that there has been these underlying tensions between the White House press corps and the administration, and most notably over this travel office story, which after all was about the press's perks and the press's travel, it has an effect. We're probably less inclined to give a president the benefit of the doubt. And so in that sense, I don't think that he necessarily needs to cater to us, and there are still ways that he can go around us and take his message over our heads. But it probably just makes good political sense for the president to have a better relationship with the White House press corps.
You recently had an article about how Hillary Clinton was handling interview requests. And she was asking a lot of people to submit questions to see what they wanted to talk about. Do you think that's a legitimate thing for a politician or a first lady to do? And would you have interviewed her if it required submitting questions in advance?
Personally, I would not. I don't think she's the first political figure to do this, but I don't think that necessarily that we have to play along. I mean, it's perfectly fine for the first lady or the president or anybody else to try to set conditions on interviews, to try to say, well, I'm only going to talk about this or that. Generally, though, when it's a president or a senator or a governor, reporters will get on the high horse and say, well, we're not going to play that game. We want the right to come in here and ask anything that we want. In Hillary's case, in Hillary Clinton's case, she is the first lady, and first lady has generally been treated differently. This first lady, obviously, is both the traditional hostess person and a player, an important player in lots of meetings on healthcare and other subjects in the White House. Secondly, though, she's been so in demand. There's so many magazines in particular that want to put her on the cover that I think she's been more able than perhaps even her husband to call the shots, to say that I'm not going to talk to certain publications, to want to screen questions in advance.
You say that most White House reporting is mediocre. What's the problem?
Part of the problem is that there are too many of us doing it. I mean, I just think that the White House beat has become a parody of PAC journalism. I mean, dozens and dozens of reporters, excellent reporters from great news organizations who follow the president around the world and record his every burp. I don't think we need that many people performing what's essentially a transcription function. It's certainly not the reporters. They tend to be some of the best reporters in town. I just think we overcover the president because, after all, as you mentioned earlier, in the age of C-SPAN, wire services, you can now get transcripts of presidential statements on computer maybe an hour after the president has spoken. How much do we bring to it? I mean, we have very little access to the president. In fact, we have very little access to most administration officials. We were trapped in that press room, particularly when you're on the road. These guys control your every movement. And yet at the same time, while everybody is covering this supposedly glamorous beat of what did the president say today, we do a hell of a lot worse job covering the federal bureaucracy, covering regulatory agencies, covering less sexy parts of the government where a lot of the real work of governing gets done. So I just think that I just think that it's a sort of a celebrity approach to political coverage because the president is the celebrity in chief, but that most of the stories tend to be repetitive.
Funny.
They tend to sort of say the same thing.
Celebrity in chief, that's good.
I like it myself.
Do you think that Clinton's recent haircut and the travel agency story, do you think they were overplayed?
My initial feeling on the travel agency story was that it was a bit overblown, that the average person in Peoria didn't care as much as reporters. But I've since revised that view. I mean, now that we've learned more about how the administration bungled it, called in the FBI improperly, tried to install Clinton's cousin as the new head of the travel office, that seems to me to be a pretty blatant political misuse, or at least there's lots of evidence to that effect. And so I think that is an important story. The haircut is one of the classic stories that the press is always going to go wild over. Is it real important in the larger context? No, but it is a symbol, and we love symbols. And, you know, the idea of Bill Clinton sitting there on the runway at LAX getting a haircut from a guy with one name did seem to raise certain questions about the populist image that he preferred to project. And so, sure, we overplayed it a little bit, but I don't find too much fault with us for that.
Howard, let's take a short break and then we'll come back. My guest is Howard Kurtz, and he reports on the media for The Washington Post. He's the author of the new book, Media Circus. This is Fresh Air. Howard Kurtz is my guest, author of the new book, Media Circus. Howard, you write in your book about one of the really difficult choices you had to make about the issue of disclosure. You were going to write about the Pentagon, the high-placed Pentagon official who was about to be outed by a gay magazine, and you were trying to decide whether you should use his name or just go with the high-placed Pentagon official. This is a particularly interesting story for me because I just interviewed Michelangelo Signorelli a couple of weeks ago, who's like Mr. Outer.
Yeah, absolutely. That's his claim to fame.
That's what he does. And so here it is, like 2 years after the story broke, and I'm still sitting here wondering, well, should I say a high-placed Pentagon official or should I go with that Pentagon official's name? And the dilemma was for me was, okay, it's 2 years after the fact. At least half the people listening are going to know this person's name because it's been reported in a lot of places. On the other hand, if you don't really want to go along with outing, you still feel like you're participating in it by giving the name.
You've put your finger on the dilemma precisely.
Yeah. So tell me how you handled it. What was in your like list of reasons to give the name and list of reasons not to give the name?
Right, well, let me just clarify, because I never considered writing a story that named this particular official. To me, the question was, should I write about the outing phenomenon? And should I write about the fact that there was this effort by gay activists to use a Pentagon official as a symbol of, in their view, hypocrisy, which is to say the Pentagon's policy of discharging gay soldiers and not giving security clearances. The debate at the Washington Post was never got to the point of should we name this person. It was simply should we even write a story about the process going on, and ultimately the editors decided not to. My feeling was this, and it's a dilemma we confront lots of different kinds of stories involving people's personal lives. On the one hand, I think outing is despicable. I think it's basically kind of a terrorist tactic in which people try to use the media, and sometimes the media allow themselves to be used, in order to score political points at the expense of somebody's privacy. This particular person had never defended the Pentagon's anti-gay policies. He was simply an employee, an important employee, to be sure. So I didn't quite see the hypocrisy argument that some were making. On the other hand, at the time that I was working on this, Jack Anderson had written a column, which was syndicated to 600 newspapers, naming the person. A New York TV station had used the person's name. The Advocate, which is a gay magazine based in Los Angeles, had used the person's name. And I was wondering when this was going to reach a critical mass where basically everybody would know who we were talking about. And so it seemed to me that I ought to write about what was going on because it was an important political effort, although I did not want to be in the position of going along by naming this person, and ultimately we didn't.
It was interesting to me that even in your book, which just came out, you don't name this person.
Well, it seems to me that all the same arguments are still there. I mean, this person is still publicly known. This person still doesn't want his private life discussed. And I don't see, I mean, it seems to me there's even less reason now that this person is no longer at the Pentagon because the Bush administration is no longer in power, to just for sort of titillation value, say, oh, yeah, it's so-and-so. And so I'm going to stick to to not naming him. Obviously, we're in the ridiculous position where lots of people know the name.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the same debate that went on in the William Kennedy Smith case, where the naming of the woman who has since gone public, Patty Bowman, who had accused Smith of rape, just sort of spread up the media food chain, and everybody used somebody else as a justification. You know, the NBC broadcast the name because the supermarket tabloid in Florida had printed it, and then the New York Times used the name because NBC had broadcast it. And I think the New York Times now regrets that and concedes that was not a wise decision. So to some extent, if you simply take the approach that, well, somebody else did it there, I'm going to do it, and this often comes up when rumors find their way into print, you've essentially abdicated your news judgment. You're letting someone else set your standards. At the same time, I'm the first to say that whether it's a Jennifer Flowers or some story like that, when a story does reach critical mass, and it is all over the airwaves, you can't just stick your head in the sand and pretend that your readers don't know about it. So it's a very delicate tightrope to walk.
I'm told that a lot of reporters knew that this high-placed Pentagon official was gay. Do you think that they should have reported it? If they knew that?
I guess I'm still not sure why it was news. Sure, lots of people knew. I think it was kind of an open secret. But unless, you know, the only argument for it is that, as is sometimes charged against conservative members of Congress who are actively anti-gay, and yet, if you know, someone like Robert Bauman, who then turns out to be homosexual himself, is that the person is guilty of personal hypocrisy, that they're taking a public stance that is completely at variance with their personal life. Then it seems to me there's an argument that it's news. In this case, this person happened to be a high official of the Pentagon, but I didn't see any evidence that he was publicly espousing an anti-gay line. People basically wanted to use him to get at the Pentagon, whose policies they didn't like. So, no, although I think sometimes we're in the position of keeping secrets for people that we shouldn't, and that we shouldn't be so cozy with politicians, for example, that we don't tell you things that are newsworthy. I guess I'm still not convinced that this particular matter was newsworthy.
Well, let's look at another issue that had to do with disclosure, personal disclosure, and I'm thinking about Arthur Ashe's disclosure that he had AIDS, and he made that public disclosure after he found out that his condition was about to be reported in the press. Now, you write that you're troubled by the conspiracy of silence over his disease, that a lot of reporters knew him and knew that he had AIDS, but had decided to keep that confidential. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think by any definition, Arthur Ashe is a public figure, and not famous, you know, world famous not only as a tennis player, but as a columnist, as a network commentator, as an activist, and so forth. And here we're not talking about reporting on somebody's sex life. We're talking about a life-threatening condition that did indeed, within a year, take Arthur Ashe's life. I guess, you know, and then suddenly it does come out because of an inquiry by USA Today. And we hear of all these sports writers who says, oh, yeah, I knew, but I wasn't going to tell anybody. I wonder if they would have had the same attitude had it been, for example, a life-threatening heart condition. There's something about AIDS because of the question of how it's contracted where we seem to put it in some kind of special privacy zone. And I'm not for just invading anybody's privacy anytime we feel like it, but it seems to me that Arthur Ashe being ill with a life-threatening disease, whether it's AIDS or something else, is clearly news. And those sports writers who didn't feel they needed to report it were really telling the public, this guy is my friend, and the friendship is more important than my journalistic responsibility. So it troubled me. On the other hand, I understand their position.
But, I mean, he wasn't in elected office where
our
and that's political
exactly
future is in his hands
not the
or
head
anything.
Of a company. He was not running for public office, and therefore there should be a different standard. And I would agree. It's, you know, it's not even a close call if it's somebody who is a senator or a presidential candidate. But, you know, it also obviously was going to come out at some point. And I don't know. It's tricky. I mean, would I have reported had I known? Would I have reported against his will had he asked me not to report it? He didn't want his little girl to know. I don't know. That's one of those journalistic dilemmas that's very, very difficult to solve.
I want to ask you about when something is news and when something is gossip. And you give a very kind of interesting example of this in your book. You got information from a source that Dan Quayle, and this was during the whole Murphy Brown period, was renting his Virginia home to an unwed couple who was living with the wife's two children from a previous marriage. And you thought that this was relevant and should be printed as news. Why did you think it should be printed as news, and why did it end up on the gossip page?
Well, it ended up on the gossip page of the Washington Post and then on the front page of a lot of other newspapers because of the political context at the time. Because, Dan, this was the Murphy Brown period. This was when the vice president was going around the country, criticizing the fictional Murphy Brown character as an unwed mother and talking about on One Mother's, and sort of setting himself up as a moralistic authority on this subject. And suddenly, although there was some question about whether he knew about it, we learned that he was renting out his home to an unwed couple. So it seemed like there was a question of hypocrisy, that he wasn't applying the same standards in his personal life as he was on the stump. And often gossip does become news. The famous $200 haircut also happened to originate in the gossip column of the Washington Post, and that's been one of the biggest stories of recent weeks. I basically think that we do too much gossip in the sense that stuff that we know isn't true, or we aren't sure that if it's true. And the haircut, whether you think it was an important story or not, had some factual basis. He was there sitting on the runway getting his locks trimmed by Christoph. But to take another example, a few weeks ago, every reporter in Washington had heard this rumor, supposedly from the Secret Service, that Hillary Clinton had thrown a lamp or other large object at her husband during some kind of fight in the White House. Nobody knew whether it was true. And I don't think that sort of thing should be printed. Newsweek put it in play by printing it on its gossip page, and then other people picked it up and sort of printed it with a wink and a nod. And now it's become part of the general discourse. And that kind of thing, you know, unless you can nail it down, unless you've got an eyewitness, unless you've got a real source, just seems to me we are playing the role of gossip monger when we report that sort of thing.
But I guess there's this attitude that once one big paper has it, then you have to mention it too.
Right. And this is one of the most corrosive things, I think, in the news business, is that... we are all involved in what Jerry Nachman, the former editor of the New York Post, once told me was a great race to be first, to be second. In other words, we're all dying to report this stuff because we know people are going to find it fascinating. But since we don't really have it nailed down, we'll just wait till somebody else goes. And then that gives you an excuse to get into print. You can even do it as a media story. Look at what those tabloids are up to now. And I think we need to practice a little more restraint because there is a difference between an item being in a gossip column, an unsubstantiated item, and everybody putting it at the top of their broadcasts or on a prominent page in the newspapers. But that distinction has been lost in recent years.
As a watchdog person,
yes.
Someone whose job is to watch over the press, I'm wondering if you feel that you were ever misquoted or unfairly treated in the press yourself. If you've ever been the subject of press coverage, I don't know if you have.
Yeah, occasionally I have, sure. Especially since I've taken on this job, I've been interviewed a lot. I have had instances where reporters have, they have a preconceived notion of the story and they're constantly trying to get me to say the thing that's going to make their point for them, even if I obviously don't agree or if I have reservations. Sometimes that gives me less than full confidence in my colleagues. But I've also had some good experiences where, you know, I've been interviewed on a complicated subject and the gist of what I said came across loud and clear. So it has taught me that the press is not a monolith, that some people do a good job, some people do a less than perfect job, and that it's not easy being, it's a lot easier to ask the questions than it is to be the one that answers them.
Has it affected how you quote people?
I think as both a combination of that and just complaints that people have registered over the years as I've become a little older and hopefully marginally wiser, I've tried not to fall into the temptation of just using the most inflammatory quote. That, in other words, if a person says 9 nice things about Bill Clinton and 1 real zinger, it's fine to use the zinger, but you ought to also indicate that, you know, in the course of an interview in which he generally said the president was doing a good job, he said blah, blah, blah. I think I've become more sensitive to that because it's so easy to go the other way. It's so easy to just sort of use people's words in a way that they don't intend. And so hopefully I'm learning to do that a little better.
Howard Kurtz, thank you very much for talking with us.
I enjoyed being here.
Howard Kurtz is media critic for The Washington Post and author of the new book, Media Circus. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a funny monologue about leukemia. Actor Evan Handler was performing in a Neil Simon show on Broadway when he got his diagnosis. Now he's off Broadway performing his monologue about the medical ordeal that saved his life. Also, is the new female condom good news for women? Writer Elizabeth Kay has her doubts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Guatemala, the government has announced that President Jorge Serrano has been removed from his post 1 week after he ordered emergency measures. Only last night, he had gone on radio and television to deny that he was leaving his post. Serrano's actions last week had been widely criticized by Western nations, and both the United States and the European Community announced that they were cutting off aid. In recent weeks, there have been demonstrations in Guatemala, mainly over the soaring cost of living. In Europe, Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic has consolidated his power in the wake of Parliament's ouster of Yugoslav President Josic. NPR's Silvia Pajoli says these changes may mean that hardline Serbs could be gaining power.
It's very confusing. It's very complicated. In terms of Serbian politics, the battle's not over, but certainly Milosevic is in control. But there were tremendous scuffles today at the parliament between moderate opposition deputies and the radicals of Vojislav Šešelj. The leader of the moderate opposition, Vuk Drašević, has called for a big rally of all Serbs to appear at the parliament tomorrow morning. We'll have to see if crowds show up or not. People are a bit angry, very angry at how Šešelj handled the whole thing. It was seen, you know, as a very strong arm tactics in the way Josic was ousted. We'll have to see if the people of Serbia, you know, rally around the moderate opposition or once again toe the line that Milosevic has drawn for them.
NPR's Silvia Pajoli reporting from Belgrade. An American-owned oil storage facility was reported to be in flames today in war-torn Angola. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Clinton administration sources confirmed reports that a large crude oil storage facility in the northern Angolan town of Soyo was burning. The facility, owned by Texaco, apparently caught fire this weekend. The Angolan government claimed that the former U.S.-backed rebel group UNITA set fire to the facility. The rebels captured Soyo from government troops last week, and UNITA also fired artillery shots at an offshore oil platform, accusing foreign oil companies of arming the government. However, UNITA denied that it had sabotaged the facility at Soyo. Despite past threats, the rebels said government shelling against its forces had damaged the facility instead. Meanwhile, government troops tightened security around the oil-rich province of Cabinda, and the U.S. oil company Cabinda Gulf said it was evacuating its staff from the area. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
The government said today that construction spending did not grow in April, largely because of a lack of residential building. The Commerce Department says construction spending dropped by 0.4%. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 25 points to close at 3,552.34. This is NPR News. According to studies by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, more than 35 million workers in nations of the West are expected to be out of work by the end of next year. These studies found that even countries pulled out of recession are not creating new jobs. While unemployment is expected to go down in the United States, it is expected to rise in other Western nations. Officials are projecting an unemployment rate in Western Europe next year of nearly 12%. Researchers at Harvard University are reporting new evidence that a nutrient found in fruits and vegetables can protect against cancer. David Barron of member station WBUR reports.
Folic acid, a vitamin found largely in fresh produce, seemed to protect against colon cancer in a study of more than 25,000 men and women. Scientists at Harvard Medical School report in tomorrow's Journal of the National Cancer Institute that those people who ate foods rich in folic acid and who took vitamin supplements containing the nutrient faced about a one-third reduced risk of benign tumors called colorectal adenomas. Study author Edward Giovannucci says these tumors can become cancerous.
If we can prevent these colorectal adenomas, we believe that we ultimately would prevent the subsequent risk of colon cancer.
The men and women in the Harvard study who had the lowest risk of colorectal tumors consumed about twice the government's recommended daily allowance of folic acid. For National Public Radio, I'm David Barron in Boston.
According to a trade group for purchasing managers, the nation's manufacturing was up a bit in May after a drop in April. The National Association of Purchasing Management says that corporate buying trends expanded for the seventh time in the last 8 months. But the group said that growth was slow and new company orders only increased moderately. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Evan Handler was on Broadway performing in Neil Simon's Biloxi Blues when he found out he had leukemia. That was 8 years ago. Now he's off Broadway performing a one-man show which he wrote about surviving leukemia and surviving the medical bureaucracy. The show is called Time on Fire, a comedy of terrors. New York Times theater critic Mel Gusso described it as a laceratingly funny and self-revealing show. Gusso described Handler as a fine actor, an equally fine writer, and a consummate reenactor of his own experience. Handler has been on Broadway in the original cast of Six Degrees of Separation, Brighton Beach Memoirs, Broadway Bound, and I Hate Hamlet. Before we talk about his one-man show, let's hear an excerpt from the beginning of Time on Fire.
"I'm afraid it is not good news," is what he said. "It is bad news. It is in the bone marrow. It's an acute myeloid leukemia." Now, for some reason, this doctor, in my memory, has turned into Richard Nixon. If Richard Nixon ever got interested in acting in the movie, I'd give him the part. We were in the doctor's office for some time after that, me, my parents, and my girlfriend Jackie. There was some talk of intensive chemotherapy, remission rates. The phrase "not curable" hit me from somewhere. I only remember that I kept rubbing the side of my face really hard. "Okay, okay, okay," I finally said, and everyone seemed a little bit startled, as if they'd forgotten that I was actually there in the room with them. "I have to get out of here now. We can talk about all this later," and I got up to go. "I wouldn't wait very long," Dr. Nixon said, and we stumbled out of his office and into the street. At 8 a.m. the next morning, I became patient number 865770. We'd pulled some strings to get me admitted to a world-class treatment center right away, but we were totally unprepared for the bureaucratic hell that would greet us when we checked in. I guess I had a vision of something like traffic being stopped on 68th Street so the kid with cancer could pass. At least I expected to be treated as someone who was in great emotional pain and about to undergo great physical pain as well. And that's exactly how I was to be treated. New York style. We were herded along with hordes of others to an admitting waiting room on the first floor. We waited for an hour and a half before my name was called, and I was directed to sit in a cubicle with a very thin young woman. There was a lipstick-stained cigarette burning in an ashtray on her desk. The woman immediately began firing ridiculously mundane questions at me in a heavily accented mumble without ever making eye contact once. I thought to myself, oh, of course, of course. These people train at the same school as the token booth clerks. Then the woman said something to me that sounded like, "Make a buck up to X-ray, push a dove in a smocker, and wait for a technician." She pulled a form from her typewriter, handed it to me, and reloaded, all without looking up. After typing several more lines, she stopped and looked over at me for the first time. Once I had her attention, I was so pleased that a big smile broke out across my face. She was quite pretty when she wasn't scowling. Now she was just staring at me blankly. I said, "Thank you." She sat looking at me like a cow looks at you when you say moo.
That's Evan Handler performing an excerpt of his show, Time on Fire. When you got sick, you were starring in Neil Simon's Biloxi Blues. One of my favorite moments is when one of your doctors says to you, "Oh, I don't really care for Neil Simon myself."
Yeah, that was my first doctor. He was a pip.
And then a nurse says to you upon hearing that you're an actor, "Oh, Johnny Cazale died on the first floor of the hospital."
Mm-hmm, yeah.
He played Fredo in The Godfather, for our listeners who don't remember him.
Yeah, he was also great in Dog Day Afternoon.
Yeah, so this must have made you feel great.
the first hospital that I was at was a really cold-hearted place, generally speaking. There were some good people there, but it was a major institution in New York City, which I guess is one of our colder-hearted cities in general. But I found an astonishing amount of real insensitivity, and that's a lot of what the piece is about. I mean, I like to say that the piece is, anybody who's ever wanted to get back at a doctor would have a good time listening to the piece. I guess the excerpt gives you a little of that. Just the assembly line kind of thing.
Well, the hospital, when you walk into a hospital, you really do feel like you've been transported to another world, a world with a big bureaucracy and a lot of pain. What did it get to you when you'd hear people screaming as you were waiting for a treatment, or walking through the halls?
Sure, it's horrifying. I still find it horrifying. I go sometimes for checkups in different places in the next little cubicle. I think, as with a lot of systems and bureaucracies, a lot of just the way of doling out the care, the way the examination rooms are set up, those systems were formed a long time ago, before a lot of thought was given. And people realized just how important certain emotional aspects and mindsets are to recovery. I get in a lot of that in the piece as well. There's a passage about the notion of false hope and how many times I heard doctors and nurses talking about avoiding false hope, which is, a phrase that I personally find, I don't know that it exists.
What's the point of hope?
It's kind of semi-private to me.
Right.
Something's either private or not.
Right.
I think it's an oxymoron. I don't think the term hope has any connotations of certainty or absolutism. It's a desire. It's a longing, and I think that you should cultivate those desires and build on the energy of those desires. And I don't think that necessarily has to do with giving up the realistic notion that the desire may not be achieved. But to discourage people from hoping, I think, is a mistake. And I think it tends to generally protect the caregiver more than the patient. I think it protects the caregiver from having to deal with possibly the patient's failure to achieve their goal.
How did you tell your colleagues in Biloxi Blues that you were sick after you got your diagnosis?
I didn't. I was just not feeling well, and I didn't go to rehearsals for a while. And when, over the course of a week or so, I found out what the problem was, I just had my agent contact the producers, who were wonderful about it. There was a lot of care and support sent my way, but I just kind of vanished from the world for a few years, is what happened, intermittently. I mean, I came back, then I'd disappear again. And a lot of the piece, again, is written as an explanation of where people go when they disappear because of a health issue, because it's like you said, it is another world that is not visible as you walk down the street. I mean, now if I walk in certain neighborhoods of Manhattan near the hospitals that I was in, I think, oh, there's this whole society inside that building that no one on the outside is aware of.
Actor Evan Handler is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guess is Evan Handler. He's doing a one-man show that he wrote based on his experiences when he had leukemia. When you have a bone marrow transplant, as you did, you get the bone marrow usually from people in your family who have similar bone marrow makeup?
Yeah, I'll get awfully technical on you here. I'm kind of a lay doctor. But
yeah.
There are different types of bone marrow transplants. I had one called an autologous bone marrow transplant, meaning that the leukemia cells in my blood and bone marrow happened to be extremely reactive to chemotherapy, and I didn't have a direct genetic match of a relative. So they removed bone marrow from my body during a complete remission, treated it with chemotherapy drugs outside my body, then killed off all the bone marrow left inside my body with what they call super lethal doses of chemotherapy, and gave me back the bone marrow they had taken out, like a blood transfusion. And the little bone marrow cells know to travel through the bloodstream back into the bones to lodge there and to begin to reproduce. And the theory behind it is that they treat the marrow so hard that only the healthiest cells will survive and begin to repopulate the bone marrow.
How much did you want to know about all the procedures being done to you?
It became necessary for me to know everything. I mean, that was my philosophy. A lot of different people have different feelings about it. I guess I've become kind of militant. I mean, when I hear about doctors and families who choose for the patients not to inform them about certain things, I go kind of haywire. Personally, I'm a believer in information is power. And once you learn how to take control of a situation, you're in a better situation to make the best decisions for yourself. So that became necessary for me, and I think it became necessary really quickly because of the center that I was first treated at, because their priorities were to keep their system functioning smoothly. And it became clear very quickly that there were a number of drugs that I would react badly to, and you had to practically fight physically to keep from being medicated with the wrong drugs, because it required special attention, it required extra time and care being given. And, you know, I found in a number of hospitals, not all, but a quick recovery or a quick death is the most expedient solution. That, you know, really personalized care becomes a big drain on the resources of the hospital.
There was a rabbi who came in and visited you when you got really sick. Did you say to him, and by the way, Rabbi, I co-starred in the film version of The Chosen.
No, I don't know if I did. I think I pretty much...
You're too sick.
I know with the doctors, I pulled out any trump card I could use to kind of get their attention and any special treatment I could. The rabbis were pretty eager for customers. You know, all the clergy in the hospital were tromping up and down the halls and offering their services. I don't come from a religious family. The one thing that got me that's also in the piece about the rabbis was there's apparently a ceremony in the Jewish religion having to do with the Book of Life, where they sometimes rename an individual in a special ceremony in the temple. And with a new name, apparently the angel of death is unable to locate the individual and the life is spared. And that, I thought, was just one of the most marvelous things I had ever heard of. And I agreed right away to that. So that was pretty much my use of religion to get through.
After your first round of chemo, you thought you were in good shape. You went back to acting again. And you were acting in a Neil Simon play, Broadway Bound, mm-hmm. when you relapsed, when you got leukemia again.
Yeah, that's when I started wondering if Neil Simon plays were carcinogenic.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was going to ask you. I was going to advise you not to perform in his work anymore.
Well, yeah. I'm still hoping to do it again, actually.
Are you really?
Yeah. I'm a gambler.
But, you know, you were talking about false hope before.
Uh-huh.
It seems to me like that's, you know, I've heard from so many people, too many, that the worst thing is when it recurs. And you thought you were over it, and mm-hmm. you've got to deal with it again.
Yeah.
And that's just like the worst thing.
Yeah, well, I sure had a crisis of faith. I mean, I found myself in the hospital the first time, a person who hadn't been trained or brought up with much faith in anything but myself, and had to draw on that the first time, and wondered if that would be enough. So I worked a lot with kind of self-actualization stuff, psychic healers, psychotherapy, anything I could kind of get my hands on, and got through it and convinced myself that this was my path to healing and I would stay well. And when it recurred, I had a tremendous crisis of faith, just the same as if I had to have put my faith in God the first time. And what I found the second time through was I became incredibly bitter and angry, and I used that. I became a person who decided that I was going to survive as a testimonial against all the comforting positive theories that had gotten me through the first time, and what a remarkable thing it would be to survive leukemia with no faith in anything at all. And I used my anger and fury to ride me, any energy I could muster. I didn't believe that it had to be positive at that point.
Well, you know, one always hopes that if one survives a life-threatening experience, let alone two rounds of life-threatening experiences, that your ego will be put in a proper perspective and that you will have transcended certain petty things that we humans are prone to. And certainly, you know, acting is one of the fields where, like, slights to the ego are probably most frequent and oppressive. Did you feel like, well, after what I've survived, I'm transcending all these petty ego things, and if I don't get a role, I can survive that? And did it make a difference?
It has made some difference. It's still a constant struggle for me. I mean, I think actors and actresses and most people in the theater are kind of, I include myself in this, they're all soothing some sort of sickness on their own part. And I know I don't come to it from a particularly healthy place. So, and I'm still susceptible to all that stuff. As I see it now, I have like a little doorway, a little tiny window that when I really need it, I can kind of squeeze through and remember the lessons that I had learned.
Mm-hmm.
But I get really caught up in things. I mean, there's a good friend of mine who, when I was just about to go down to Baltimore for the bone marrow transplant, who I said to him, you know, if I ever get through this, I am never going to worry about anything again. I'm never going to hurry anywhere again. I'm going to sit someplace green, and I'm going to watch the sun go up and down. And about 2 or 3 years later, I met him on a day when I was sweating and frustrated and angry.
Yeah.
And he reminded me of that story, and all I wanted to do was punch him in the face as hard as I could and make him disappear from the world, because he'd shown me how I had failed to live up to what I had sworn. But life catches you up again. So I get completely caught up in life again while at the same time having a section of myself that is aware that, hey, you can stop this, you don't have to do this. And I do at times, when it gets too overwhelming, pull myself back and say, this isn't worth it. You know, this here we've reached a line. And that's kind of how it is for me. I can only speak for myself.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Evan Handler is performing his one-man show, Time on Fire, through Thursday night in New York. This is Fresh Air. The president of Guatemala has resigned. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
Tom Gibb has been covering the story, Terry, since President Serrano seized power and abolished the assembly and the courts, and apparently all that is being reversed today. The former president of the former Yugoslavia did not survive a no-confidence vote, and we'll have a report from Sylvia Poggioli. We have some medical stories, new statistics on breast cancer, and a report on the high incidence of cesarean sections at a hospital in Chicago. Some explanations for why those numbers are so high.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. One grim reality of the AIDS epidemic is that it's more likely for a woman to be infected by a man than for a man to be infected by a woman. As we all know, this fact has resulted in many new practices and some new devices. Writer Elizabeth Kay has some thoughts about the newest of them, the female condom. Listener discretion is advised.
The female condom seems like a contradiction. Men are supposed to wear the condoms, but they often don't, and I guess it does make sense for the more vulnerable partner to be most vigilant about protection. Which brings us to the female condom, the charmingly named Reality Vaginal Pouch. It's a name certain to appeal to every woman who harbors the secret wish that she had been born a marsupial. The condom is intended for moments when a woman would like to look her best, but unfortunately it's far from pretty. Its manufacturer describes it as, and I quote, a soft, loose-fitting polyurethane sheath and two polyurethane rings. One ring anchors the device inside the woman. The other ring dangles from her vagina, and there it hangs, an unexpected bit of polyurethane in an oval shape that's kind of reminiscent of the gaping mouth in that Edward Munch painting, The Scream. The Reality condom is not merely gross and unsightly, however. It also squeaks. Couples who use it describe certain noises which could lead you to think you have a third party in bed with you, if, that is, you are the sort of person who would call a mouse a third party. So, while the reality is pretty much the opposite of the chastity belt, it may produce the same result. On a practical note, you should know that the reality condom has a failure rate that the FDA estimates at around 26%, that it can be used only once, and that it costs $2.25, which is 3 times the price of a male condom. And, in a pun you may assume to be wholly unintended, it provides what its manufacturer calls broad coverage. The female condom strikes me as an interesting coda to the Year of the Woman, which was so hyped and so celebrated in a society that has never had even the dimmest necessity for decreeing the Year of the Man. And we all saw how quickly the Year of the Woman turned into the Year of the Waif, when fashion models appear to be underage and stunned on the head by something heavy. The fact is, the more women mature, and the more mature women there are, the more we hear about Woody and Joey Buttafuoco and all those other so-called adults who feel safest with little girls. Little girls are malleable and dependent. The mature woman takes care of herself, and now you can always recognize her, in certain circumstances at least, because she is the one with that cute little ring between her legs. I don't know how you feel about it, but for me, those early days of the sexual revolution that once seemed so bawdy now seem quaint and innocent. There was no fear of disease. You didn't have to get pregnant. All there was the psychic damage we were all sure we were hip enough to avoid. I guess they were wild times, and yet memory cast them as oddly touching. It's always touching to recall a time that is innocent in the genuine sense, that is, a time when you can enjoy the delusion that there will be no price to pay. But today, old values are up for scrutiny or up for sale, and the female condom is here to remind us that the biblical equation of sex and death has been recycled into one of the primary concerns of the late 20th century. And beyond any aesthetic revulsion, distaste for that condom hints, I'm pretty sure, at a deep and aching nostalgia for a sweeter life, a life whose fundamentals include the ability to equate abandon with passion, to equate trust with love. And finally, the word on the reality condom is both good and bad. Women can be sexy and free. They can be relatively safe from disease. That is the good news. The bad news is that they can be only one of these things at a time.
Elizabeth Kay is a freelance writer based in New York. She contributes to the New York Times and Esquire. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Roger Voblaitis, Chris Fraley, Bob Alls, and Joyce Lieberman. Roberta Shurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Joe Carol Pierce is a terrific songwriter you've probably never heard of. That's why a lot of her Texas friends and admirers have recorded her songs on a new tribute album. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk to Pierce, a self-described bad girl who is now one of Austin's best-loved songwriters. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.